Georgia Tech was not as selective in admissions back then as it is today, and it relied instead on a sort of Darwinian weeding out process, focused entirely on grades. As Clough tells it, it was a very cold social and academic environment. Not a lot of fun. Even by the early 1990s, Georgia Tech was graduating only 65% of its incoming students. Students were not finishing because they found both the curriculum and the atmosphere rather gray, and the school a place that did not celebrate student success. Clough's view, as he assumed the presidency, was that our country desperately needed more good scientists, engineers, and entrepreneurs, so his school couldn't afford to be losing one-third of its prospective grads by graduation day. Clough said he realized that only by offering the right education, not just more education, would we get more students applying and more students graduating. Clough began rethinking Georgia Tech's approach by reflecting on his own experiences as a working engineer. He knew from his own life that some of the best engineers he had collaborated with over the years had not been the best engineering students. They knew how to think creatively, he said. They might not be the ones who could solve the calculus equation better than anyone else, but they were the ones who could define the problem that the calculus had to solve better than anyone else. They were often people with character, and that something intangible. The more time he spent on campus, the more Clough also noticed that an awful lot of the talented students were interested in creative outlets other than what they were experiencing in the classroom. Filmmaking or music making or some other offbeat hobby. These students were interesting people when you talked to them. I began to think, boy, wouldn't it be nice to have more of these sorts of interesting people around campus? It makes the place more enjoyable, and it helps make the student who is more one-dimensional more multidimensional by having them bump shoulders with these other kinds of kids. So Clough decided to do something about it. Beginning in the late 1990s, he gradually altered the admissions policies at Georgia Tech, having his admissions office focus specifically on recruiting and admitting good engineering students who also played musical instruments, sang in a chorus, or played on a team. The idea was that people who have other interests tend to be able to communicate, tend to be more social, tend to ask for help more readily when they need help, tend to help others more who need help, tend to think horizontally, tend to be able to tie things together from different disciplines and fields. The result, said Clough, today more than 50% of Georgia Tech's entering freshmen have played musical instruments or participated in some kind of musical group. So many that Clough's biggest challenge now is building more recital rooms and concert areas on campus. I created a monster, he joked. He also created more graduates. Graduation rates rose from 65% when he arrived to 76% by 2005. And they are different kinds of graduates. The student response has been great, said Clough. We have seen a large increase in students taking music courses. We had little in the way of chamber ensembles, and now we have over a dozen. We never had a chamber orchestra group on this campus. Now we have five. We have computer music synthesizing groups, jazz groups, and virtual and robotic drummers all over the place. Virtual drumming is a technology that allows you to point at any object and it starts to drum, only at tech school. The robotic drums use artificial intelligence to trigger the drumming. Our virtual and robotic drumming group has been invited to Europe for performances. At the same time, Georgia Tech's large music ensembles, like the marching band and the symphony orchestra, have increased significantly in numbers of participants and sophistication, and smaller groups, like its glee clubs and a cappella groups, have also grown dramatically. We're talking Georgia Tech, folks, not Juilliard. Students are seeking these kinds of opportunities, added Clough. So many, in fact, that we had an old high school on campus that we renovated into our music building, and an old church with a big main hall that worked for some of our singing groups. We also created more casual places for students to exercise their talents, like a stage in the new student center. Clough's effort to make Georgia Tech sing was helped when, in 1996, Georgia Tech served as the Olympic Village, housing athletes for the Atlanta Olympics. Georgia Tech's band director was selected as director of the Olympics band. When the games were over, Georgia Tech was offered the chance to buy many of the instruments the musicians had used for half price. "So we doubled the size of our band overnight," said Clough. "That was one of the triggers that got us started. It was great stuff. Because of that, we have 24 tubas in our marching band. Very few schools have 24 tubas. You check it out next time you watch a bowl game." And very few presidents of premier technology universities boast about their tubas as much as their test tubes. But Clough has reason to boast, because my guess is that by making Georgia Tech sing, and by making other user-friendly additions to the undergraduate teaching system, and by making education overseas easily available for Georgia Tech students, he is producing not just more engineers, but more of the right kind of engineers. People who play instruments or are part of a band have more social skills. They are not just burrowed down in their work, said Clough. And that kind of person, he added, has a better chance of synthesizing and orchestrating insights from many different fields. For instance, said Clough, there is going to be a big demand for engineering around photonics, turning sunlight into electricity. That requires students who are trained in basic engineering, chemical engineering, and electrical engineering. Clough quoted the head of a big engineering firm as telling him recently, "Don't send me engineers who can be duplicated by a computer. I'm sending that work to India. Send me engineers who are adaptable, who can think across disciplines." As above, so below. Georgia Tech's College of Computing has picked up on these road themes and has translated them into specific courses. After the dot-com bubble burst, computer science enrollment at Georgia Tech started to drop precipitously. "Everyone was reading the articles about all the jobs going to India and China," said Rich DeMillo, the former HP chief technology officer who is now dean of the College of Computing. "The number one question from parents was, what will my kid do if all the programming jobs go offshore?" So DeMillo and Merrick First, the associate dean, who was brought in from the International Computer Science Institute at Berkeley, went out into the business world and asked employers two simple questions. Who were they looking to hire, and how were computer geeks being used to add value at their companies? They visited CNN's headquarters in Atlanta, for instance, and were exposed to the massive amounts of digital and analog content the network had piled up. It became obvious that managing all of this content via computing and finding ways to develop it, from televisions to cell phones to video iPods to websites, was going to be a huge growth industry for the right computer science grads, ones who could help tell stories with technology. After thinking all this through, in 2004, DeMillo and First redesigned the computer science major at Georgia Tech around 9 threads, as they refer to them. Each thread is a combination of computing with another field, producing a synthesis of knowledge, where the real value is going to be created. Threads represent a departure from a vertically oriented curriculum whose goal is the creation of students with a fixed set of skills and knowledge, explained First in his course description. A thread is a fundamentally horizontal idea whose goal is to give students the broad collection of skills and learning experiences they need to thrive in the globally competitive conceptual age. A thread provides an intuitive, flexible, and mutually strengthening set of courses that allows a student to craft his or her own distinctive future. The 9 threads are computing and intelligence, computing and embodiment, computing and internet working, computing and platforms, computing and information, computing and people, computing and media, computing and modeling, and computing foundations. You need to take 2 threads to get a degree in computer science today from Georgia Tech. The computing and media thread, for instance, requires students to take courses in computer science, communications, writing, and liberal arts. The idea behind this thread, said First, is to teach students what they need to know to tell stories and create experiences for humans through technology. Here you'll see courses on topics ranging from computational graphics to Hamlet, from human perception to interactive fiction engines. So, for instance, if you want to be a top-notch game designer, this is where to start. The Computing and People thread prepares students by helping them to understand the theoretical and computational foundations for designing, building, and evaluating systems that treat the human being as a central component. The student who pursues Computing and People might want to combine it with Computing and Embodiment to study human-robot interaction. There are almost as many mix-and-match permutations with these threads as there are coffee options at Starbucks. Imagine, wrote DeMillo in an essay describing his program, a Georgia Tech undergraduate computer science student in her sophomore year interested in computer security. She might combine the computing and information thread to learn how data is stored, retrieved, encoded, and transmitted with the computing and people thread to learn how people use technology and how to run experiments with human subjects. She will craft a valuable computing identity and become someone able to design, invent, and build secure computing systems enabling people to securely manage their information. The point about each of these threads, individually and in combination, said DeMillo, is that they provide a skill set and credential basis that allows graduates to create value in ways beyond what would be possible with only a narrowly focused tool set. And that skill set is certain to have value in the emerging flat world marketplace. 25 years ago, computer science was easy, added DeMillo. 25 years ago, there was a clear stack: hardware, software, and algorithms. And if you could fit in anywhere in that stack, you had a job. You just picked one of those sweet spots to specialize in, and you were off and running. You could work on hardware, you could program system software, or you could work on application algorithms. Now, fast forward 25 years. There is no clear-cut hardware, software, algorithm stack. Instead, there is business process, change management, and ERP. Now, it is all horizontal and in constant motion. So if you are an educator, what do you do? What remains unchanged is the need to be able to tell stories, to be able to build things that have intelligence in them, and to be able to create networks. All that remains constant. But now the way you do that is by aggregating pieces horizontally. The threads are aimed at putting things together that make sense. That is why you need to run a whole university this way. The whole notion of separate departments is crazy. You really need to change the whole approach. This is not about small tinkering. What the Georgia Tech model recognizes is that the world is increasingly going to be operating off the flat world platform with its tools for all kinds of horizontal collaboration. So schools had better make sure they are embedding the tools and concepts of collaboration into the education process. It has to run through the whole curriculum, said First. It can't just be a single course. Otherwise, we will never nurture a high enough percentage of the population to be competitive. The right country. So if these are the jobs and the pathways to the new middle, let's step back and ask, how well-suited is America generally in this flattening world to creating these jobs and paving these pathways? The short answer is that we have, in theory, all it takes to produce the jobs and educate the sorts of people who will thrive in a flat world. Yes, we really do. Let's go down the list. To begin with, we have a relatively flexible, deregulated, free market economy with lots of experimentation and competition between states and universities, like Georgia Tech. The general flexibility of the American economy is a huge asset at a time when constant change is required to stay competitive. So far, America has not succumbed either to economic protectionists who want to put up walls to keep jobs in, or national security protectionists who want to keep workers out. As Senator Jim DeMint of South Carolina once remarked to me, the one thing we can't do is try to protect our way to prosperity. It is essential that we stay as open and flexible as possible. America's cultural willingness to tear things down and rebuild them anew gives us an enormous advantage in the age of flatness, when you are required to tear down and build up more often to achieve innovation and growth. We made the transition from agriculture to industry, and then from industry to services. Now we need to go to the next phase, which is services delivered globally. Each of these transitions was wrenching in its own way, but we were able to accomplish each faster and more efficiently than any other major economy because we were open and flexible and let the market do its work, which it did, though not without pain for plenty of people. The transition to the flat world will be particularly wrenching because it is likely to touch many more white-collar workers. Nevertheless, this is no time to freeze up. You Americans have all the things you need to get your people from the old middle to the new middle, said Nandan Nilekani of Infosys. If you get through this transition first, you will be kings of the hill. But if people lose their nerve and protectionists come along and start building walls, you will fail. It is an act of faith. You have to believe that it will happen. Underneath this umbrella of flexibility, America has a myriad of institutional strengths. It starts with America's network of research universities, which spin off a steady stream of competitive experiments, innovations, and scientific breakthroughs, from mathematics to biology to physics to chemistry. Underneath this umbrella of flexibility, America has a myriad of institutional strengths. It starts with a network of research universities, which spin off a steady stream of competitive experiments, innovations, and scientific breakthroughs, from mathematics to biology to physics to chemistry. Our university system is the best, said Bill Gates. We fund our universities to do a lot of research, and that is an amazing thing. High IQ people come here, and we allow them to innovate and turn their innovations into products. We reward risk-taking. Our university system is competitive and experimental. They can try out different approaches. There are 100 universities making contributions to robotics, and each one is saying that the other is doing it all wrong, or my piece actually fits together with theirs. It is a chaotic system, but it is a great engine of innovation in the world, and with federal tax money, with some philanthropy on top of that, it will continue to flourish. We will really have to screw things up for our absolute wealth not to increase. If we are smart, we can increase it faster by embracing this stuff. The web browser, magnetic resonance imaging, MRI, superfast computers, global position technology, space exploration devices, and fiber optics are just a few of the many inventions that got started through basic university research projects. The Bank Boston Economics Department did a study titled MIT, The Impact of Innovation. Among its conclusions was that MIT graduates have founded 4,000 companies, creating at least 1.1 million jobs worldwide and generating sales of $232 billion. What makes America unique is not that it built MIT, or that its grads are generating economic growth and innovation, but that every state in the country has universities trying to do the same. America has 4,000 colleges and universities, said Alan E. Goodman, president of the Institute of International Education. The rest of the world combined has 7,768 institutions of higher education. In the state of California alone, there are about 130 colleges and universities. There are only 14 countries in the world that have more than that number. Take a state you normally wouldn't think of in this regard, Oklahoma. It has its own Oklahoma Center for the Advancement of Science and Technology, OCAST, which, on its website, describes its mission as follows. In order to compete effectively in the new economy, Oklahoma must continue to develop a well-educated population, a collaborative, focused university research and technology base, and a nurturing environment for cutting-edge businesses from the smallest startup to the largest international headquarters. OCAS promotes university business technology centers, which may span several schools and businesses, resulting in new businesses being spawned, new products being manufactured, and new manufacturing technologies employed. No wonder that in 2003, American universities reaped $1.3 billion from patents, according to the Association of University Technology Managers. Coupled with America's unique innovation-generating machines, universities, public and private research labs, and retailers, we have the best regulated and most efficient capital markets in the world for taking new ideas and turning them into products and services. Dick Foster, director of McKinsey & Co. and the author of two books on innovation, remarked to me, "We have an industrial policy in the U.S. It is called the stock exchange, whether it is the NYSE or the NASDAQ. That is where risk capital is collected and assigned to emerging ideas or growing companies," Foster said, "and no capital market in the world does that better and more efficiently than the American one. The easy availability of venture capital to fund new products and innovations is a hugely important factor in enabling America to get the most of the flat world platform. Why? Because old traditional companies are rarely early adopters or innovators of the next great breakthrough technology. The people who invented radio didn't invent television. CBS didn't invent CNN. LexisNexis didn't invent Google. Having lots of venture capital and capitalists around, though, to take a risk and underwrite the next Google, CNN, or other untested innovation means that those individuals who want to get the most out of the flat world platform, who really understand its power to create new products, forms of entertainment, and communities, can do so. What makes capital provision work so well in America is the security and regulation of our capital markets, where minority shareholders are protected. Lord knows there are scams, excesses, and corruption in our capital markets. That always happens when a lot of money is at stake. What distinguishes our capital markets is not that Enrons don't happen in America. They sure do. It is that when they happen, they usually get exposed, either by the Securities and Exchange Commission or by the business press, and get corrected. What makes America unique is not Enron, but Elliot Spitzer, the Attorney General of New York State, who has doggedly sought to clean up the securities industry and corporate boardrooms. This sort of capital market has proved very, very difficult to duplicate outside of New York, London, Frankfurt, and Tokyo. Said Foster, "China and India and other Asian countries will not be successful at innovation until they have successful capital markets, and they will not have successful capital markets until they have rule of law which protects minority interests under conditions of risk. We in the U.S. are the lucky beneficiaries of centuries of economic experimentation, and we are the experiment that has worked." While these are the core secrets of America's sauce, there are others that need to be preserved and nurtured. Sometimes you have to talk to outsiders to appreciate them, such as Indian-born Vivek Paul of Wipro. "I would add three to your list," he said to me. "One is the sheer openness of American society." We Americans often forget what an incredibly open, say-anything, do-anything, start-anything, go-bankrupt-and-start-anything-again society the United States is. There is no other place like it in the world, and our openness is a huge asset and attraction to foreigners, many of whom come from countries where the sky is not the limit. Another, said Paul, is the quality of American intellectual property protection, which further enhances and encourages people to come up with new ideas. In a flat world, there is a great incentive to develop a new product or process because it can achieve global scale in a flash. But if you are the person who comes up with that new idea, you want your intellectual property protected.
No country respects and protects intellectual property better than America, said Paul.
And as a result, a lot of innovators want to come here to work and lodge their intellectual property. The United States also has among the most flexible labor laws in the world. The easier it is to fire someone in a dying industry, the easier it is to hire someone in a rising industry that no one knew would exist 5 years earlier. This is a great asset, especially when you compare the situation in the United States to inflexible, rigidly regulated labor markets like Germany's, full of government restrictions on hiring and firing. Flexibility to quickly deploy labor and capital where the greatest opportunity exists, and the ability to quickly redeploy it if the earlier deployment is no longer profitable, is essential in a flattening world. Still another secret to America's sauce is the fact that it has the world's largest domestic consumer market, with the most first adopters, which means that if you are introducing a new product, technology, or service, you have to have a presence in America. All this means a steady flow of jobs for Americans. There is also the little-discussed American attribute of political stability. Yes, China has had a good run for the past 25 years, and it may make the transition from communism to a more pluralistic system without the wheels coming off, but it may not. Who would want all his or her eggs in that basket? If you wanted to summarize the net effect of all these institutions, cultural norms, business practices, and legal systems, it can be reduced to one word: trust. They create and inspire a high level of trust, and a high level of trust is the most important feature any open society can possess. Trust, in many ways, is the product of all the ingredients in America's secret sauce. We are a high-trust country because we agree that we are going to be governed by a set of values and principles reflected in our institutions and laws, which are higher and more enduring than any individual, said Dove Seidman, the founder of LRN, the company that provides ethics and governance advice for global corporations, which I will discuss in detail in Chapter 11. Together, these norms and institutions create predictability and confidence that creates trust, a trust that my innovations will be protected, a trust in my currency, and a trust in my justice system. And all of that, argued Seidman, propels innovation. Why? Because in a high-trust society such as America, people know what ground they are standing on all the time and can count on a certain framework of rules and principles to govern their personal and business lives. If you jump off sand and another person jumps off a hard floor, asked Seidman, who jumps higher? The person who jumps off a hard floor, of course. Well, trust is that hard floor. It is what gives you the predictability that allows you to take a big leap. Without trust, there is no risk-taking, and without risk-taking, there is no innovation. If you want to get more people to take the necessary risk to innovate, just put more trust in the room. No low-trust society will ever produce sustained innovation. In a flat world where value is increasingly created and complex problems increasingly solved, by whom you connect and collaborate with, having a high-trust society is even more of an advantage. Having an abundance of trust is essential in a world of collaboration, added Seidman, because the more people trust each other or their leaders, the more likely they are going to work well together. Indeed, the United States has become one of the great meeting points in the world, a place where lots of different people bond, learn to trust one another, and build myriad horizontal friendships and alliances. An Indian student who is educated at the University of Oklahoma and then gets his first job with a software firm in Oklahoma City forges bonds of trust and understanding that are really important for future collaboration, even if he winds up returning to India. Nothing illustrates this point better than Yale University's outsourcing of research to China. Yale President Richard C. Levin explained to me that Yale has two big research operations running in China today,
one at Peking University in Beijing and the other at Fudan University in Shanghai. Most of these institutional collaborations arise not from top-down directives of university administrators, but rather from long-standing personal relationships among scholars and scientists, said Levin. How did the Yale-Fudan collaboration arise? To begin with, said Levin, Yale professor Tian Zhu, its director, had a deep affiliation with both institutions. He did his undergraduate work at Fudan and received his PhD from Yale. Five of Professor Zhu's collaborators, who are now professors at Fudan, were also trained at Yale, explained Levin. One was Professor Zhu's friend when both were Yale graduate students. Another was a visiting scholar in the laboratory of a Yale colleague. One was an exchange student who came to Yale from Fudan and returned to earn his PhD in China. And the other two were postdoctoral fellows in Professor Zhu's Yale lab. A similar story underlies the formation of the Peking-Yale Joint Center for Plant Molecular Genetics and Agrobiotechnology. Professor Zhu is a leading expert on genetics and has won grants from the National Institutes of Health and the Howard Hughes Foundation to study the connection between genetics and cancer and certain neurodegenerative diseases. This kind of research requires the study of large numbers of genetic mutations in lab animals. When you want to test many genes and trace for a given gene that may be responsible for certain diseases, you need to run a lot of tests. Having a bigger staff is a huge advantage, explained Levin. So what Yale did was essentially outsource the lab work to Fudan by creating the Fudan-Yale Biomedical Research Center. Each university pays for its own staff and research, so no money changes hands. But the Chinese side does the basic technical work using large numbers of technicians and lab animals, which costs so much less in China, and Yale does the high-end analysis of the data. The Fudan staff, students, and technicians get great exposure to high-end research, and Yale gets a large-scale testing facility that would have been prohibitively expensive if Yale had tried to duplicate it in New Haven. A support lab in America for a project like this one might have 30 technicians, but the one in Fudan has 150. The gains are very much two-way, said Levin. Our investigators get substantially enhanced productivity, and the Chinese get their graduate students trained, and their young faculty become collaborators with our professors, who are the leaders in their fields. It builds human capital for China and innovation for Yale. Graduate students from both universities go back and forth, forging relationships that will no doubt produce more collaborations in the future. At the same time, he added, a lot of legal preparation went into this collaboration to make sure that Yale would be able to harvest the intellectual property that is created. There is one world of science out there, said Levin, and this kind of international division of labor makes a lot of sense. Yale, he said, also insisted that the working conditions at the Chinese labs be world-class, and as a result, it has also helped to lift the quality of the Chinese facilities. The living conditions of the lab animals are right up to U.S. standards, remarked Levin. These are not mouse sweatshops. Put all the above together and you have America's secret sauce, a mix of institutions, laws, and cultural norms that produce a level of trust, innovation, and collaboration that has enabled us to thrive for more than two centuries and constantly renew our economy and raise our standard of living. There is nothing about the flat world, nothing that Americans cannot handle, as long as we roll up our sleeves, educate our young people the right way for these times, and tend to and enrich the secrets of our sauce. So are we doing that? That's what the next two chapters are about. But let me give you a hint. The answer is no.
The Quiet Crisis. The truth is, we are in a crisis now, but it is a crisis that is unfolding very slowly and very quietly. It is a quiet crisis, explained Shirley Ann Jackson, the 2004 president of the American Association for the Advancement of Science and president of Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute since 1999. And this quiet crisis involves the steady erosion of America's scientific and engineering base, which has always been the source of American innovation and our rising standard of living. The sky is not falling. Nothing horrible is going to happen today, said Jackson, a physicist by training who chooses her words carefully. The U.S. is still the leading engine for innovation in the world. It has the best graduate programs, the best scientific infrastructure, and the capital markets to exploit it. But there is a quiet crisis in U.S. science and technology that we have to wake up to. The U.S. today is in a truly global environment, and those competitor countries are not only wide awake, they are running a marathon while we are running sprints. If left unchecked, this could challenge our preeminence and capacity to innovate. It is our ability to constantly innovate new products, services, and companies that has been the source of America's horn of plenty and steadily widening middle class for the last two centuries. It was American innovators who started Google, Intel, HP, Dell, Microsoft, and Cisco, and it matters where innovation happens. The fact that all these companies are headquartered in America means that most of the high-paying jobs are here, even if these companies outsource or offshore some functions. The executives, the department heads, the sales force, and the senior researchers are all located in the cities where the innovation happened. And their jobs create more jobs. The shrinking of the pool of young people with the knowledge skills to innovate won't shrink our standard of living overnight. It will be felt only in 15 or 20 years when we discover we have a critical shortage of scientists and engineers capable of doing innovation or even just high-value-added technology work. Then this won't be a quiet crisis anymore, said Jackson. It will be the real McCoy. By the time Jackson took the job as Rensselaer Polytechnic's president to put her heart and soul into reinvigorating American science and engineering, she realized, she said, that a perfect storm was brewing, one that posed a real long-term danger to America's economic health, and she started speaking out about it whenever she could. The way to avoid being caught in such a storm is to identify the confluence of factors and to change course, even though right now the sky is blue, the winds are gentle, and the water seems calm. In the fiscal year 2005 budget passed by the Republican-led Congress in November 2004, the budget for the National Science Foundation, which is the federal body most responsible for promoting research and funding more and better science education, was actually cut by 1.9%, or $105 million. History will show that when America should have been doubling the NSF funding, its Congress passed a pork-laden budget that actually cut assistance for science and engineering. Don't be fooled by the calm. That's always the time to change course, not when you're just about to get hit by the typhoon. We don't have any time to waste in addressing the dirty little secrets of our education system. Dirty little secret number one. The numbers gap. In the Cold War, one of the deepest causes of American worries was the so-called missile gap between us and the Soviet Union. The perfect storm Shirley Ann Jackson is warning about could best be described as the confluence of three new gaps that have been slowly emerging to sap America's prowess in science, math, and engineering. They are the numbers gap, the ambition gap, and the education gap. Dirty little secret number one is that the generation of scientists and engineers who were motivated to go into science by the threat of Sputnik in 1957 and the inspiration of JFK are reaching their retirement years and are not being replaced in the numbers that they must be if an advanced economy like that of the United States is to remain at the head of the pack. According to the National Science Foundation, half of America's scientists and engineers are 40 years or older, and the average age is steadily rising. Every 2 years, the National Science Board supervises the collection of a very broad set of data trends in science and technology in the United States, which it publishes as Science and Engineering Indicators. In preparing Indicators 2004, the NSB said, "We have observed a troubling decline in the number of U.S. citizens who are training to become scientists and engineers, whereas the number of jobs requiring science and engineering, S&E, training continues to grow. These trends threaten the economic welfare and security of our country," it said, adding that if the trends identified in Indicators 2004 continue undeterred, three things will happen. The number of jobs in the U.S. economy that require science and engineering training will grow. The number of U.S. citizens prepared for those jobs will, at best, be level. And the availability of people from other countries who have science and engineering training will decline, either because of limits to entry imposed by U.S. national security restrictions or because of intense global competition for people with these skills. The NSB report found that the number of American 18 to 24-year-olds who receive science degrees has fallen to 17th in the world, whereas we ranked third 3 decades ago. It said that of the 2.8 million first university degrees, what we call bachelor's degrees, in science and engineering granted worldwide in 2003, 1.2 million were earned by Asian students in Asian universities, 830,000 were granted in Europe, and 400,000 in the United States. In engineering specifically, universities in Asian countries now produce 8 times as many bachelor's degrees as the United States. These shortages could not be happening at a worse time, just when the world is going flat. The number of jobs requiring science and engineering skills in the U.S. labor force, the NSB said, is growing almost 5% per year. In comparison, the rest of the labor force is growing at just over 1%. Before September 11, 2001, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, BLS, projected that science and engineering occupations would increase at 3 times the rate of all occupations. Unfortunately, the NSB reported, the average age of the science and engineering workforce is rising. Many of those who entered the expanding S&E workforce in the 1960s and 1970s, the baby boom generation, are expected to retire in the next 20 years, and their children are not choosing science and engineering careers in the same numbers as their parents, the NSB report said. The percentage of women, for example, choosing math and computer science careers fell 4 percentage points between 1993 and 1999. The 2002 NSB indicators showed that the number of science and engineering PhDs awarded in the United States dropped from 29,000 in 1998 to 27,000 in 1999. The total number of engineering undergraduates in America fell about 12% between the mid-1980s and 1998. Nevertheless, America's science and engineering labor force grew at a rate well above that of America's production of science and engineering degrees because a large number of foreign-born S&E graduates migrated to the United States. By attracting scientists and engineers born and trained in other countries, we have maintained the growth of the S&E labor force without a commensurate increase in support for the long-term costs of training and attracting native U.S. citizens to these fields, the NSB said. But now, the simultaneous flattening and wiring of the world have made it much easier for foreigners to innovate without having to emigrate. They can now do world-class work for world-class companies at very decent wages without ever having to leave home. In addition, visas for students and S&E workers have been issued more slowly since the events of September 11th, owing to both increased security restrictions and a drop in applications. The U.S. State Department issued 20% fewer visas for foreign students in 2001 than in 2000. And the rate fell farther in subsequent years. While university presidents told me in 2004 that the situation was getting better and that the Department of Homeland Security was trying to both speed up and simplify its visa procedures for foreign students and scientists, a lot of damage has been done. And the situation for foreign students or scientists wanting to work in any areas deemed to have national security implications is becoming a real problem. No wonder New York Times education writer Sam Dillon reported on December 21, 2004, that foreign applications to American graduate schools declined 28% this year. Actual foreign graduate student enrollments dropped 6%. Enrollments of all foreign students in undergraduate, graduate, and postdoctoral programs fell for the first time in 3 decades in an annual census released this fall. Meanwhile, university enrollments have been surging in England, Germany, and other countries. Chinese applications to American graduate schools fell 45% this year, while several European countries announced surges in Chinese enrollment. Dirty little secret number 2, the ambition gap. The second dirty little secret, which several prominent American CEOs told me only in a whisper, goes like this. When they send jobs abroad, they not only save 75% on wages, they get a 100% increase in productivity. Part of that is understandable. When you take a low-wage, low-prestige job in America, like a call center operator, and bring it over to India, where it becomes a high-wage, high-prestige job, you end up with workers who are paid less but motivated more. The dirty little secret is that not only is outsourcing cheaper and efficient, the American CEO of a London-headquartered multinational told me, but the quality and productivity boost is huge. In addition to the wage compression, he said, one Bangalore Indian retrained will do the work of 2 or 3 Europeans, and the Bangalore employees don't take 6 weeks of holidays. When you think it's only about wages, he added, you can still hold your dignity, but the fact that they work better is awful. In the winter of 2004, I had tea in Tokyo with Richard C. Koo, chief economist for the Nomura Research Institute. I tested out on Richard my coefficient of flatness. That is, the ideal country in a flat world is the one with no natural resources, because countries with no natural resources tend to dig inside themselves. They try to tap the energy, entrepreneurship, creativity, and intelligence of their own people, men and women, rather than drill an oil well. I am a Taiwanese American with a father from Taiwan and a Japanese mother, Koo told me. I was born in Japan and went to Japanese elementary school and then moved to the States. There is a saying in China that whatever you put in your head and your stomach, no one can take away from you. In this whole region, that is in the DNA. You just have to study hard and move forward. I was told relatively early by my teachers, we can never live like Americans and Canadians. We have no resources. We have to study hard, work hard, and export hard. A short time later, I read a column by Stephen Perlstein, the Washington Post's business columnist slash reporter, under the headline, Europe's Capitalism Curtain. From Wrocław, Poland, July 23, 2004, Perlstein wrote, a curtain has descended across Europe. On one side are hope, optimism, freedom, and prospects for a better life. On the other side, fear, pessimism, suffocating government regulations, and a sense that the best times are in the past. This new curtain, Perlstein argued, demarks Eastern Europe, which is embracing capitalism, and Western Europe, which is wishing desperately that it would go away. This time, however, it is the East that is likely to prevail, he continued. The energy and sense of possibility are almost palpable here. Money and companies are pouring in. Not just the prestige nameplates like Bombardier, Siemens, Whirlpool, Toyota, and Volvo, but also the network of suppliers that inevitably follows them. At first, most of the new jobs were of the semi-skilled variety. Now they have been followed by design and engineering work that aims to tap into the largest concentration of university students in Eastern Europe. The secret isn't just lower wages. It's also the attitude of workers who take pride and are willing to do what is necessary to succeed, even if it means outsourcing parts production or working on weekends or altering vacation schedules, things that would almost certainly trigger months of acrimony and negotiation in Western Europe. It is that pride and determination, says Wroclaw's mayor, that explains why they are such a threat to the leisure time society on the other side of the curtain. I heard a similar refrain in a discussion with consular officials who oversee the granting of visas at the U.S. Embassy in Beijing. As one of them put it to me, "I do think Americans are oblivious to the huge changes. Every American who comes over to visit me in China is just blown away. Your average kid in the U.S. is growing up in a wealthy country with many opportunities, and many are the kids of advantaged, educated people and have a sense of entitlement. Well, the hard reality for that kid is that 15 years from now, Wu is going to be his boss, and Zhou is going to be the doctor in town. The competition is coming, and many of the kids are going to move into their 20s clueless about these rising forces." When I asked Bill Gates about the supposed American education advantage, an education that stresses creativity, not rote learning, he was utterly dismissive. In his view, those who think that the more rote learning systems of China and Japan can't turn out innovators who can compete with Americans are sadly mistaken. Said Gates, "I have never met the guy who doesn't know how to multiply who created software. Who has the most creative video games in the world? Japan. I never met these rote people. Some of my best software developers are Japanese. You need to understand things in order to invent beyond them." One cannot stress enough. Young Chinese, Indians, and Poles are not racing us to the bottom. They are racing us to the top. They do not want to work for us. They don't even want to be us. They want to dominate us, in the sense that they want to be creating the companies of the future that people all over the world will admire and clamor to work for. They are in no way content with where they have come so far. I was talking to a Chinese American who works for Microsoft and has accompanied Bill Gates on visits to China. He says Gates is recognized everywhere he goes in China. Young people there hang from the rafters and scalp tickets just to hear him speak. Same with Jerry Yang, the founder of Yahoo. In China today, Bill Gates is Britney Spears. In America today, Britney Spears is Britney Spears. And that is our problem. Dirty little secret number 3, the education gap. All of this helps to explain the third dirty little secret. A lot of the jobs that are starting to go abroad today are very high-end research jobs, because not only is the talent abroad cheaper, but a lot of it is as educated as American workers, or even more so. In China, where there are 1.3 billion people and the universities are just starting to crack the top ranks, the competition for top spots is ferocious. The math/science salmon that swims upstream in China and gets itself admitted to a top Chinese university or hired by a foreign company is one smart fish. The folks at Microsoft have a saying about their research center in Beijing, which, for scientists and engineers, is one of the most sought-after places to work in all of China. Remember, in China, when you are one in a million, there are 1,300 other people just like you. The brain power that rises to the Microsoft Research Center in Beijing is already one in a million. Microsoft has 3 research centers in the world. In Cambridge, England, Redmond, Washington, its headquarters, and in Beijing. Bill Gates told me that within just a couple of years of its opening in 1998, Microsoft Research Asia, as the center in Beijing is known, had become the most productive research arm in the Microsoft system in terms of the quality of the ideas that they are turning out. It is mind-blowing. Kai-Fu Lee is the Microsoft executive who was assigned by Gates to open the Microsoft Research Center in Beijing. My first question to him was, "How did you go about recruiting the staff?" Lee said his team went to universities all over China and simply administered math, IQ, and programming tests to PhD-level students or scientists. In the first year, we gave about 2,000 tests all around, he said. From the 2,000, they winnowed the group down to 400 with more tests, then 150. And then we hired 20. They were given 2-year contracts and told that at the end of 2 years, depending on the quality of their work, they would either be given a longer-term contract or granted a postdoctoral degree by Microsoft Research Asia. Yes, you read that right. The Chinese government gave Microsoft the right to grant postdocs. Of the original 20 who were hired, 12 survived the cut. The next year, nearly 4,000 people were tested. After that, said Lee, we stopped doing the test. By that time, we became known as the number one place to work, where all the smart computer and math people wanted to work. We got to know all the students and professors. The professors would send their best people there, knowing that if the people did not work out, it would be their credibility on the line. Now we have the top professors at the top schools recommending their top students. A lot of students want to go to Stanford or MIT, but they want to spend 2 years at Microsoft first as interns so they can get a nice recommendation letter that says these are MIT quality. Today, Microsoft has more than 200 researchers in its China lab and some 400 students who come in and out on projects and become rooting material for Microsoft. Microsoft is a stronger American company for being able to attract all this talent, said Lee. Now we have 200 more brilliant people building intellectual property and patents. These 200 people are not replacing people in Redmond. They are doing new research in areas applicable worldwide. Microsoft Research Asia has already developed a worldwide reputation for producing cutting-edge papers for the most important scientific journals and conferences. This is the culture that built the Great Wall, he added, because it is a dedicated and direction-following culture. Chinese people, explained Lee, have both a superiority and an inferiority complex at the same time, which helps explain why they are racing America to the top, not the bottom. That sort of inspired leadership in science and engineering education is now totally missing in the United States. In the wake of the Bush administration and the Republican Congress's decision to cut the National Science Foundation funding for 2005, Republican Congressman Vern Ehlers of Missouri, a voice in the wilderness, made the following statement. While I understand the need to make hard choices in the face of fiscal constraint, I do not see the wisdom in putting science funding behind other priorities. We have cut NSF despite the fact that this omnibus bill increases spending for the 2005 fiscal year, so clearly we could find room to grow basic research while maintaining fiscal constraint. But not only are we not keeping pace with inflationary growth, we are actually cutting the portion basic research receives in the overall budget. This decision shows dangerous disregard for our nation's future. And I am both concerned and astonished that we would make this decision at a time when other nations continue to surpass our students in math and science and consistently increase their funding of basic research. We cannot hope to fight jobs lost to international competition without a well-trained and educated workforce. No, we cannot. And the effects are starting to show. According to the National Science Board, the percentage of scientific papers written by Americans has fallen 10% since 1992. The percentage of American papers published in the top physics journal, Physical Review, has fallen from 61% to 29% since 1983. And now we are starting to see a surge in patents awarded to Asian countries. From 1980 to 2003, Japan's share of world industrial patents rose from 12% to 21%, and Taiwan's from 0% to 3%. By contrast, the U.S. share of patents has fallen from 60% to 52% since 1980. Every 4 years, the United States takes part in the Trends in International Mathematics and Science Study, which assesses students after 4th grade and 8th grade. Altogether, the most recent study involved roughly 500,000 students from 41 countries and the use of 30 languages, making it the largest and most comprehensive international study of education that has ever been undertaken. The 2004 results for tests taken in 2003 showed American students making only marginal improvements over the 2000 results, which showed the American labor force to be weaker in science than those of its peer countries. The Associated Press reported December 4, 2004, that American 8th graders had improved their scores in science and math since 1995, when the test first was given, but their math improvement came mainly between 1995 and 1999, and not in recent years. The rising scores of American 8th graders in science was an improvement over 1999, and it lifted the United States to a higher ranking relative to other countries. The worrying news, though, was that the scores of the American 4th graders were stagnant, neither improving nor declining in science or math since 1995. As a result, they slipped in the international rankings as other countries made gains. Asian countries are setting the pace in advanced science and math. Ina Mullis, co-director of the International Study Center at Boston College, which manages the study, told the AP, "As one example, 44% of 8th graders in Singapore scored at the most advanced level in math, as did 38% in Taiwan. Only 7% in the United States did." No wonder there is not a major company that I interviewed for this audio program that is not investing significantly in research and development abroad. It is not follow the money, it is follow the brains. "Science and math are the universal language of technology," said Tracy Kuhn, Intel's director of corporate affairs, who oversees the company's efforts to improve science education. "They drive technology and our standards of living. Unless our kids grow up knowing that universal language, they will not be able to compete. We are not in the business of manufacturing somewhere else. This is a company that was founded here, but we have two raw materials. Sand, which we have a ready supply of, and talent, which we don't. Silicon comes from sand." "We looked at two things," she continued. "We looked at the fact that in disciplines that were relevant to our industry, the number of U.S. students graduating at the master's and Ph.D. levels was declining in absolute numbers and relative to other countries. In our K-12, we were doing okay at the fourth grade level. We were doing middle of the road in the 8th grade, and by the 12th grade, we were hovering near the bottom in international tests related to math. So the longer kids were in school, the dumber they were getting. You have teachers turning off kids because they were not trained. You know the old saw about the football coach teaching science? People who do not have the ability to make this accessible and gripping for kids." "One of the problems in remedying the situation," said Kuhn, "is the fact that education in America is relatively decentralized and fragmented. If Intel goes to India or China or Jordan and introduces a teacher education program for making science more interesting, it can get into schools all over the country at once. In America, the public schools are overseen by 50 different state governments. While Intel does sponsor research at the university level that will benefit its own product development, it is growing increasingly concerned about the feeder system into those universities and the job market." "Have we seen any change here?" "No, not really," said Kuhn. "So Intel has been lobbying the INS for an increase in the number of advanced foreign engineers allowed into the United States on temporary work visas." "Intel has to go where the IQ is. Remember," she repeated, "Intel's chips are made from just two things, sand and brains. Right now, the brains are the problem. We will need a stronger and more supportive immigration system if we want to hire the people who want to stay here. Otherwise, we will go where they are." "What are the alternatives?" "I am not talking about data programmers or people with BS degrees in computer science. We are talking about high-end specialized engineering. We have just started a whole engineering function in Russia where engineers have wonderful training. And talk about underemployed. We are beefing that up. Why wouldn't you?" "Wait a minute. Didn't we win the Cold War? If one of America's premier technology companies feels compelled to meet its engineering needs by going to the broken-down former Soviet Union, where the only thing that seems to work is old-school math and science education, then we've got a quiet little crisis on our hands. One cannot stress enough the fact that in the flat world, the frontiers of knowledge get pushed out farther and farther, faster and faster. Therefore, companies need the brain power that can not only reach the new frontiers, but push them still farther. That is where the breakthrough drugs and software and hardware products are going to be found. And America either needs to be training that brain power itself or importing it from somewhere else, or ideally, both, if it wants to dominate the 21st century the way it dominated the 20th. And that simply is not happening. There are two things that worry me right now, said Richard A. Rashid, the director of research for Microsoft. One is the fact that we have really dramatically shut down the pipeline of very smart people coming to the United States. If you believe that we have the greatest research universities and opportunities, it all has to be driven by IQ. In trying to create processes that protect the country from undesirables, the government has done a much better job of keeping out desirables. A really significant fraction of the top people graduated from our universities in science and engineering were not born here, but stayed here and created the businesses and became the professors that were engines for our economic growth. We want these people. In a world where IQ is one of the most important commodities, you want to get as many smart people as you can. Second, said Rashid, we have done a very poor job of conveying to kids the value of science and technology as a career choice that will make the world a better place. Engineering and science is what led to so many improvements in our lives. But you talk to K through 12 kids about changing the world, and they don't look at computer science as a career that's going to be a great thing. The amazing thing is that it is hard to get women into computer science now, and getting worse. Young women in junior high are told this is a really wretched lifestyle. As a result, we are not getting enough students through our systems who want to be computer scientists and engineers. And if we cut the flow from abroad, the confluence of those two will potentially put us in a very difficult position 10 or 15 years from now. It is a pipeline process. It won't come to roost right away. But 15 or 20 years from now, you'll find you don't have the people and the energy in these areas where you need them. From Richard Rashid at Microsoft in the Northwest, to Tracy Kuhn at Intel in Silicon Valley, to Shirley Ann Jackson at Rensselaer on the East Coast, the people who understand these issues the best and are closest to them have the same message. Because it takes 15 years to create a scientist or advanced engineer, starting from when that young man or woman first gets hooked on science and math in elementary school, we should be embarking on an all-hands-on-deck, no-holds-barred, no-budget-too-large crash program for science and engineering education immediately. The fact that we are not doing so is our quiet crisis. Scientists and engineers don't grow on trees. They have to be educated through a long process. Because, ladies and gentlemen, this really is rocket science. This is not a test. As a person who grew up during the Cold War, I'll always remember driving along down the highway and listening to the radio when suddenly the music would stop and a grim-voiced announcer would come on the air and say, "This is a test of the emergency broadcast system." And then there would be a 30-second high-pitched siren sound. Fortunately, we never had to live through a moment in the Cold War where the announcer came on and said, "This is not a test." That, however, is exactly what I want to say here. This is not a test. The long-term opportunities and challenges that the flattening of the world puts before the United States are profound. Therefore, our ability to get by doing things the way we've been doing them, which is to say, not always tending to our secret sauce and enriching it, will not suffice anymore. If this moment has any parallel in American history, it is the height of the Cold War, around 1957, when the Soviet Union leaped ahead of America in the space race by putting up the Sputnik satellite. Yes, there are many differences between that age and our own. The main challenge then came from those who wanted to put up walls. The main challenge to America today comes from the fact that all the walls are being taken down, and other countries can now compete with us much more directly. The main challenge in that world was from those practicing extreme communism, namely Russia, China, and North Korea. The main challenge to America today is from those practicing extreme capitalism, namely China, India, and South Korea. The main objective in that era was building a strong state. The main objective in this era is building strong individuals. What this era has in common with the Cold War era, though, is that to meet the challenges of flatism requires as comprehensive, energetic, and focused a response as did meeting the challenge of communism. It requires our own version of the new frontier and great society adapted to the age of flatness. It requires a president who can summon the nation to get smarter and study harder in science, math, and engineering in order to reach the new frontiers of knowledge that the flat world is rapidly opening up and pushing out. And it requires a great society that commits our government to building the infrastructure, safety nets, and institutions that will help every American become more employable in an age when no one can be guaranteed lifetime employment. I call my own version of this approach compassionate flatism. Getting Americans to rally around compassionate flatism is much more difficult than getting them to rally around anti-communism. National peril is a lot easier to convey than individual peril, noted Johns Hopkins University foreign policy expert Michael Mandelbaum. Economics, as noted, is not like war, because economics can always be a win-win game. But sometimes I wish economics were more like war. In the Cold War, we actually got to see the Soviets parade their missiles in Red Square. We all got to be scared together, from one end of the country to the other. And all our politicians had to be focused and serious about marshaling the resources and educational programs to make sure Americans could keep pace with the Soviet Union. But today, alas, there is no missile threat coming from India. The hotline, which used to connect the Kremlin with the White House, has been replaced by the helpline, which connects everyone in America to call centers in Bangalore. While the other end of the hotline might have had Leonid Brezhnev threatening nuclear war, the other end of the helpline just has a soft voice eager to help you sort out your AOL bill or collaborate with you on a new piece of software. When it comes to responding to the challenges of the flat world, there is no helpline we can call. We have to dig into ourselves. It is going to take the sort of focus and national will that President John F. Kennedy called for in his famous May 25, 1961 speech to Congress on urgent national needs. At that time, America was recovering from the twin shocks of Sputnik and the Soviet space launch of a cosmonaut, Yuri Gagarin, less than 2 months before Kennedy's speech. Kennedy knew that while America had enormous human and institutional assets, far more than the Soviet Union, they were not being fully utilized. In that speech, Kennedy made a vow that has amazing resonance today. I am therefore transmitting to the Congress a new manpower development and training program to train or retrain several hundred thousand workers, particularly in those areas where we have seen chronic unemployment as a result of technological factors, in new occupational skills over a 4-year period, in order to replace those skills made obsolete by automation and industrial change with the new skills which the new processes demand. Amen. We too have to do things differently. We are going to have to sort out what to keep, what to discard, what to adapt, what to adopt, where to redouble our efforts, and where to intensify our focus. This is just an intuition, but the flattening of the world is going to be hugely disruptive to both traditional and developed societies. The weak will fall farther behind faster. The traditional will feel the force of modernization much more profoundly. The new will get turned into old quicker. The developed will be challenged by the underdeveloped much more profoundly. I worry, because so much political stability is built on economic stability, and economic stability is not going to be a feature of the flat world. Add it all up, and you can see that the disruptions are going to come faster and harder. Think about Microsoft trying to figure out how to deal with a global army of people writing software for free. We are entering an era of creative destruction on steroids. Even if your country has a comprehensive strategy for dealing with flatism, it is going to be a challenge of a whole new dimension. But if you don't have a strategy at all, well, you've been warned. This is not a test. Being an American, I am most focused on my own country. How do we go about maximizing the benefits and opportunities of the flat world and providing protection for those who have difficulty with the transition without resorting to protectionism or runaway capitalism? I offer compassionate flatism, which is a policy blend built around five broad categories of action for the age of flat: leadership, muscle building, cushioning, social activism, and parenting. Leadership. The job of the politician in America, whether at the local, state, or national level, should be, in good part, to help educate and explain to people what world they are living in and what they need to do if they want to thrive within it. One problem we have today, though, is that so many American politicians don't seem to have a clue about the flat world. As venture capitalist John Doerr once remarked to me, "You talk to the leadership in China, and they are all the engineers, and they get what is going on immediately. The Americans don't, because they're all lawyers." I am not saying we should require all politicians to hold engineering degrees, but it would be helpful if they had a basic understanding of the forces that are flattening the world, were able to educate constituents about them, and galvanize a response.